closing argument. Walter Hudson. Pursuing happiness thoughtfully. 8 to 10 weeknights on Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
Gonna start things out a little deeper than we usually do for a Freestyle Friday. Usually on Fridays, we kind of do our mop-up of stories that fell through the cracks during the week. We also take your phone calls at 651-989-5855 and give you wide latitude to steer the show in whatever direction you so desire. We're going to do that tonight. Your calls are always welcome, and we'll go in whatever direction you want to go. But as far as the topics that I'm bringing to the table tonight, at least for this first couple of segments, perhaps the first hour, yeah, it's not going to be lighthearted to go into your weekend. We're going to do a little bit of thinking tonight, a little bit of reflecting. And the topic is the family, the importance of family, the morality of family, and how family, you know, because, you know, here's the observation I think we need to start with. And I've said this on the program before. Some years back, right about the time that the Tea Party became a thing, with the election of Barack Obama and the conviction that something had to be done in order to preserve our economic liberties, a decision was made in a kind of de facto ad hoc fashion throughout the conservative, libertarian, Republican ecosphere to set aside quote-unquote social issues. We decided that we weren't going to emphasize divisive social issues anymore because we needed to focus on things like taxes and where our health care comes from and the Constitution and upholding the Republic and its structure, its constitutional structure. That had to be our priority. And so we set social issues on the back burner if we paid them any lip service at all. This, in retrospect, in my opinion, was a huge mistake. Because by doing so, we, in a weird way, it's almost as if we were lying to ourselves. Like we either forgot or never really learned that there's a connection between these two supposed different paths of thought. That there's a connection between the quote-unquote social issues and the economic issues. The same morality applies to both. And if we don't address how we behave in a social context, then we're not going to have a moral premise upon which to advocate for economic premises. And the left has no confusion on this point. You notice this? The left isn't separating their social issue stances from their economic stances. It's all one big happy family, so to speak, ironically, to use an ironic analogy. It's all in the same boat for them. And they never made any sort of strategic decision to emphasize one over the other. They've been constantly railing from their perceived moral high ground consistently for all these years without any break on both the social side of the discourse spectrum and the economic side as well. So they recognize that there's a connection there. And there's a piece here at Mises.org. Great find by Brad Omland, our producer, that gets into what this connection is and why it's so important and suggests why we ought to spend more time thinking about it and focusing upon it as conservatives. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. And you can call in, as we said, 651-989-5855 for Freestyle Friday.
Yeah, I don't know if listeners out there have their home web page as something like the Drudge Report or Fox News, but I would really encourage you to maybe change that to the Mises Institute or Cato or Reason. They're putting out much better material and much like higher level thinking material than your typical news source.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, as somebody who, as a matter of occupation, has to read a lot of articles every day, most of the stuff that I go through and go over for my prep for the show, you know, I don't read the whole article. I skim a couple of paragraphs. I get the gist of what the news is or what the nugget, the discussion piece, the talking point is, and then I move on to the next one. When I read something from Mises or Reason, typically I find myself having to read the entire article.
Well, and it's not just news, too. They're incorporating the philosophy into it, too. And you get that
right,
not only in just the news articles, but the philosophical articles like this one as well.
So, you know, they start off here, and this is Jonathan Newman writing at Mises. They start off here with a, not immediately, his headline is, "Why Do Socialists Hate Families?" And so you would expect him to dive right into talking about that, right? But he doesn't start with talking about families off the bat. He talks about economic theory. He writes, "One of Ludwig von Mises' most important contributions was to point out that economic calculation is impossible under socialism." And this is what he means by that. "Meeting consumer demands requires that factors of production are allocated to the right lines of production in the right quantities at the right time, and that they are combined in the right ways to produce what consumers want and need. Entrepreneurs make these decisions in a market economy, but they are dependent on the prices of factors of production to make their decisions. They must compare these prices to the anticipated prices of the consumer goods to be able to say yes or no to any production plan. Socialism, however, means that private ownership of the factors of production is abolished." Now, I want to pause here to just go back and summarize, rework that first paragraph, because it's pretty dense. What Jonathan Newman is saying here in encapsulating Mises' idea is the same thing we've talked about on the program many, many times before whenever we've paused to dissect the concept of price. What price is, what price means, why price is so important. Price is information, right? It's a number. And it tells you, without any sort of, without expounding, without imparting any expertise to you about the underlying supply and demand and production elements that go into producing a particular product or service, it tells you what the economic value of a product or service is. And entrepreneurs and consumers and actors in the marketplace can look at prices as they make decisions regarding what they're going to do, how they're, whether they're going to increase their supply of a given thing or pass on it, and whether or not it's going to be profitable for them to produce a certain product given the prices of what goes into it in terms of labor and supplies and materials. All that price information is absolutely essential to communicating to all the parties involved what they should do. Should I buy more or should I hold back? Should I sell some? Should I eat more? Should I eat less? Right? Should I consume more? Should I consume less? Like, all of these questions that happen in with every individual in the market and every company in the market every day, 500 times a day, are influenced by price. And so it's extraordinarily important that those prices be accurate, that those prices not be interfered with, because that's how people know what they should do next, rationally, how they're capable. It's the information people need in order to make rational decisions. Jonathan Newman continues, "Socialism, however, means that private ownership of the factors of production is abolished, which means there can be no exchange of factors of production. In other words, that communication of price does not take place. No exchange means no prices, which are vital bits of information for entrepreneurs in a market economy. Whoever is in charge of making production decisions in a socialist regime will be groping about in the dark without the use of market prices for the factors of production. This is why socialist experiments always end in disaster. The death toll for socialist experiments like the USSR is easily beyond 100 million. Resources are wasted instead of used to make food, medicine, shelter, energy, clothing, and other necessities." Interestingly, another key tenet of socialism, besides abolishing the ownership of the factors of production, is abolishing the family. This is strange because the traditional nuclear family seems like it could be used in producing convincing socialist rhetoric. It is, after all, a good example of social bonds without private property, prices, and capitalistic exploitation. Yet Marx, Engels, and many of their modern followers are anti-family. And then he goes on, Jonathan Newman here writing at Mises goes on to provide several excerpts from their written works, the Marxists, that indicate their animosity towards the family. And then Newman continues writing, for Marx, the family represents a microcosm of capitalism. But why didn't he identify it as a microcosm of socialism to argue that if socialism is feasible at the family level, then it could be feasible at a larger scale? After all, family members do not use prices to convey information to each other about the demands for food, yard work, what vacation to go on, vacuuming, board games, transportation to events, or other things family members do for and with each other. While there are some items and rooms in the house that are used more often by one family member than the others, we do not really have justable private property. In other words, you're not going to take your two siblings aren't going to take each other to court over what belongs in each person's room. They might argue about it, but they're not going to make it a federal case. I am not accumulating IOUs for my daughter every time I provide food for her, Newman writes. He continues, exceptions to this norm or ideal are just that, exceptions. Sometimes parents pay their children to do certain chores, but we can hardly call that payment a market price. It's more of an educational exercise to teach children responsibility and the value of money earned. No one could argue that these prices are the foundation of the family's economy, preventing them from falling into calculational chaos. I can't say why Marxists so dislike the family, except to say that it's only fitting that the people so wrong about human nature would be wrong about the institution of the family. But it's worth exploring how families can thrive without prices when macroeconomies crumble without them. And what follows, and we're going to have to explore this on the other side of our first break here tonight. What follows in this piece by Jonathan Newman at Mises.org is a breakdown of three factors which explain how it is that families function more or less like a socialist commune, and why they're able to, and why, in spite of the fact that families function that way, the broader society cannot. And this is absolutely key, because, you know, you see this type of rhetoric employed in the discourse, do you not? What was the name of Hillary Clinton's book she wrote? It Takes a Village. You see rhetoric along the lines of, oh, well, we're all one big happy family. The family of the USA, the global family, we should all treat each other as though we're brothers and sisters here on Earth. Now, there's a certain sense in which that's true, right? Like the kind of benevolence that you afford a stranger when you first meet them, the assumption that they're not a threat, the assumption that they're not a criminal, that they're a decent human being, until you get evidence to the contrary. In that sense, there is this brotherhood of humanity. But we're not all brothers and sisters in the sense of a nuclear family, not by any stretch of the imagination. And there's a reason for that. We'll delve into it when we return. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. We're about halfway through this piece, written by Jonathan Newman at Mises.org, wherein he argues, or he tries to answer the question, why do socialists hate families? And he, thus far, we've seen his reframing or articulation of what price is, how it works, and how important the mechanism of price is as a medium for conveying information to both producers and consumers in the market. Price is how we know what we should do, generally speaking, whether we should buy, whether we should sell, whether we should consume, whether we should save. Price tells us this, and without price, there is chaos. And this is evidenced in everywhere where socialist regimes have been given full rein to interfere in the economy. It results in starvation and ruin. And from that premise, Newman goes on to ask the question, you know, why then are socialists so antagonistic towards the family? Because, you know, on the surface level, the family acts sort of as a socialist commune, right? You know, there isn't really private property between family members, so to speak. It's very communal. There aren't prices quoted for services rendered, hopefully, within your home, right? Between all the parties concerned. So, you know, why isn't the family held up as a model for socialism? And in fact, why is there such antagonism if you go back and you read the literature written by the likes of Marx and Engels? Why is there so much antagonism from socialists towards the family? And he attempts to answer that as we continue here. But before we go any further, let's take a couple of your calls. 651-989-5855. It is Freestyle Friday, by the way. So if you want to throw a big wrench in our gears and take us in a totally different topical direction, we can do that as well. Let's start with Dom in Maple Grove. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Walter. Thanks for taking the call.
Yep.
You know, I was just driving home, and it was kind of strange. We were talking about this with my son the other day. You know, socialism, I just kind of, I don't know if I want to disagree with you or I have a different point of view, but socialism at the family level is a whole different ballgame to me. I haven't read that article, but
yeah.
Based on what you were talking about, you know, we all have, if you want to exercise or implement socialism at a family level, we all have skin in the game because we are too close to each other. We're going to be able to see who's getting hurt by taking certain actions. That's not the case as far as I understand. Give you examples at a national level. Ocasio Cortez won because she had a millionaire boyfriend who had organized all those things. And personally, she doesn't have any problem probably becoming a capitalist after, because she's already looking up for a book deal at the end of her term. Bernie Sanders at his town hall in Fox News, he says, I don't have any problem. I'm not going to apologize because I became a millionaire because I wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they don't have any issues imposing socialism on other people with other people's money. Unfortunately, we do not have any really forceful leader on the Republican or conservative side that can articulate a value like, hey, this is good for the country at the national level, because that's too far-fetched for the average individual to comprehend. Because hey, I'm going to work, I gotta make money,
yeah,
I gotta, you know, put food on the table. That's what I'm looking for. We do not have a leader. Trump has come pretty close to it. I'm not going to apologize for who I am, but this is what you guys need to do too. And Reagan was the other person. We don't have anybody that can articulate that on the conservative side. That's my issue with most of these people. When you turn into a politician, you gotta be, you know, he's trying to defend his job more than he's trying to do the job. That's my problem.
I hear you, Dom, and you're getting a little bit ahead of us. And
No,
I'm glad you did, and I think you'll be satisfied with where we end up landing in our continued consideration of this article.
Great discussion, though. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks for calling. Let's talk to Joe in Dresser, Wisconsin. Appreciate you calling.
Hey, I hope you can hear me okay. I'm in a tractor ripping up Mother Earth and burning diesel fuel right now.
So. You're loud and clear.
All right. I just wanted to call in. I couldn't call last night, and I could have just been spitting tacks when you guys were talking about Trump. You had people calling in and saying that
we had a bizarre streak of anti-Trump callers last night who weren't even leftists. They were within the Republican Party, so that was interesting.
It was, and you know, I'm objective. Obviously, Trump is not beyond criticism. I mean, I can give you a list of things that I wish he either didn't do or did differently. So that's not a problem, but they've got to be legitimate. And to me, those callers demonstrated perfectly why conservatives are so successful at losing. They still haven't learned anything. I was just a kid. I think I'm about the same age as you when Reagan was president. Look how polite he was. Look how well he articulated liberty, and he was treated like dirt too. And what they haven't learned is that there is no everybody getting along.
Correct.
With the left. Their
Correct.
Idea, I mean, they eat their own. Their
right.
Idea is you need to be 100% in lockstep with us. Otherwise we will destroy you.
Right.
And one of the greatest gifts about Trump, even though he's not perfect, is he fights back, and he is, through his comments, his tweets, whatever, he could do less of it, but he makes them expose themselves. And
right.
Actually, on both sides, he's exposed a lot of Republicans that are way too entrenched also, and that's, there's many things I love about him, but that's one of the best is now you can really see the Democrat Party, a lot of them have been this way before. They just have been able to successfully hide it. And he's like a worm in their ear, and they're going nuts, and they're having to expose themselves, and they're having to be honest, finally.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to see another Donald Trump in the sense of, you know, his overall personality. However, there are certain characteristics that Donald Trump has brought to the table that absolutely positively need to become like bedrock foundations of what future candidacies are built upon. And one of them you allude to, which is, you know, this not giving an inch to the opposition at all, assuming their malice instead of doing what the likes of, say, a John Kasich, who's one of the people that was brought up by one of the callers last night, or a Mitt Romney or a John McCain, you know, this game that they would play where they would pretend as though, you know, we're all one big happy family, bipartisan family, and we all want the same things, and we all kind of have the same goals, and we all have the best interest of the country at heart. And, oh, you know, we should be polite, and we should treat each other with decorum and what have you. And listen, as unto themselves, are those values laudable and virtuous? Of course they are. But you can only be polite to somebody who is benevolent toward you. You can't be polite towards somebody who wants to destroy you. And that's the situation that we're in. The left wants to destroy us. They want to destroy our capacity. I mean, you talk about these socialist ideas that we've been covering. And we've talked about it a lot this week. The effect of these policies is literal death. I mean, no joke. In the article here from Jonathan Newman at Mises.org, he talks about 100 million people dead as a result of the USSR. That's a fact. That is literal physical death wherever these ideas are implemented consistently and relentlessly. And so that's what we're up against. You can't be polite in the face of that. You got to fight it tooth and nail. And Trump brings that to the table. And, you know, one of the big reasons why, you know, I've come around on Trump over the past couple of years is, you know, number one, a growing appreciation for that aspect of his personality in spite of the things that I wish he did differently. But then also exactly what you cite, Joe, Trump's traits have drawn out. They have pulled back the curtain on the Democratic Wizard of Oz. And we now see who these people really are, and they are monstrous. They are monstrously evil and intent upon destroying anybody who steps out of line from they're bigots, basically, because that's the definition of bigotry. Complete and total stubborn intolerance of anybody who disagrees with you. And they're willing to eat their own, even in that regard.
And the other thing, too, is he's pulled the, I mean, I 100% agree with you, but he's also pulled back the curtain on the Republicans. Just quickly, look at the last four presidents we've had. That's two Republicans, two Democrats, and what has the net result been from every one of them? Increased taxes, more regulation, loss of liberty for the American people. And, I mean, you can go through and give examples easily. And, like I say, I realize he's not perfect. I don't have a problem with criticism. But trying to say that he is to blame for their behavior. I mean, these people are talking about killing babies after
right.
they're born. I mean,
right.
really?
Right.
We're going to blame Trump for that? I mean, I know he burnt down the cathedral in Paris because when he passed his tax cut, the climate temperature immediately increased and it's continuously combusted.
Right.
But still, you know, besides that, he's doing pretty good.
Yeah. I appreciate the call, Joe. When we come back, I want to get back into this article from Mises.org from Jonathan Newman, and he gets into the three factors that contribute to why families more closely resemble a socialistic commune than they do a free market. And the reasons are actually quite rational and ironically demonstrate why socialism could never work outside of a nuclear family unit. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Net, that don't kill me, can only make me stronger. I need you to hurry.
Jonathan Newman, writing Mises.org, wonders how it is that socialists, going all the way back to Marx and Engels, the founding fathers of the anti-life philosophy, prescription known as socialism, why they have an aversion to the family and they write in no uncertain terms regarding their desire to see the family abolished, why they have this aversion to the family when it appears, at least on the surface, that the family is a perfect model for communistic ideas? I mean, isn't the way a family interacts basically a commune, common property, held in kind, doing things for one another, from each according to his need or according to his ability, to each according to their need? Certainly that describes the relationship between parents and children, does it not? So shouldn't this be held up as an example of how the broader society ought to work? Why the antagonism? Well, before delving into that question, Jonathan Newman, writing at Mises.org, gets into, you know, what the differences are, the reason for how it's even possible for families to operate in a commune fashion. Because the broader society in a free market certainly relies upon the mechanism of price to interact with one another and to know what they ought to do. Prices tell us whether we should buy, whether we should sell, whether we should consume, whether we should save. And you don't have that same dynamic within the family. Why is that? Well, he explains here, focusing on three different characteristics. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. It is Freestyle Friday, so if you want to steer us in a random direction, go back to one of the topics we were talking about earlier in the week, we welcome that. 651-989-5855. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. So the three unique aspects of the nuclear family that enable it to operate more or less as a commune. Number one, knowledge. Jonathan Newman writes, one answer is that families are kind of like Caruso on his island. Caruso can allocate factors of production toward his wants and needs without prices because they are his wants and needs. He knows exactly how much time to work toward the production of coconuts and berries because he knows he prefers the marginal unit of one food to the other. Family members do not share a mind, but they are intimately aware of what the other members want and need more so than anybody outside the family. This is sometimes communicated directly, like when deciding on what to cook for dinner, but it is also something learned over time. After spending so much time with somebody, you become like an expert entrepreneur who is able to anticipate the other's preferences. This doesn't scale up to the national level, obviously. I do not have intimate knowledge of what some random individual in Wisconsin will want to eat 7 months from now, but this is the sort of anticipation entrepreneurs make on a daily basis, many times unknowingly, by producing capital goods in intermediate stages of production years before the random Wisconsinite even realizes he is hungry. As I said before, they can only make these production decisions with the help of market prices for the factors of production. Factor number two, after knowledge, care. Another reason families don't fall apart without prices is that family members actually deeply care about each other's well-being, and sometimes they do not know, or they do know, what's best for you even when you disagree. It's not enough to say that a mother knows what her child wants and needs. She must also want the best for her child. Thus, families overcome, or are pretty good at dealing with, a knowledge problem and an incentive problem. While I don't want the random Wisconsinite to go hungry 7 months from now, it's not a high priority for me. I don't have anything against that guy in Wisconsin. It's just that I can only care about so many causes, and my family is more important to me due to quite a few factors, including proximity, my religious beliefs, my own subjective preferences, and the expectations of friends and other family. Market economies overcome this with prices. By offering to pay for various goods and services, I offer an incentive to others to provide for me. This works vice versa in a division of labor, and it works beautifully. The most famous passage in The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith describes this phenomenon. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. The dictators, central planning boards, and workers' collectives of socialism cannot care for each individual like we care for our family members, and they cannot care for each individual's specific wants and needs like entrepreneurs in a market economy can, even if it is a profit motive. I'd rather a greedy capitalist sell me the food I want than a central planning board arranging for my starvation in the name of free food. Now, I want to process this point a little bit because this is absolutely key. This goes back to what we've been talking about all week on the program. Coming out of the conversation that I had with students and attendees at the University of Minnesota on Tuesday, where I was hosted by CFACT and Students for Liberty, and talked with them about winning the moral argument. And when I talked about self-interest as a moral premise and the morality under which we ought to operate, what Jonathan Newman writes here about caring about your family members and caring about your own profit motive and your self-interest as an enabling factor, as an incentive to actually serve other people. This is the counterintuitive notion that the left can't get their hands around. They can't understand, or they refuse to understand, more likely, that caring about my own well-being, caring about my own profit, is the mechanism that drives me to care for others. Why is it that when you go out to eat and you sit down at a restaurant, that a good waiter treats you extraordinarily well? Your drink isn't even empty yet, and they come and fill it up or ask you if you'd like another, depending upon what you're drinking, right? They check in on you as soon as you sit down. And if they're good, they'll check back a couple minutes later and ask you what you want. And if you're not ready yet, they'll give you some time, not too much, not too soon, little. They're tuned in to your needs. Why? Because they love you? Because they really care about you as a person? No. They're looking for a tip. They're looking to get paid. And it's the same thing with the folks in the kitchen, right? And this dynamic takes place in every non-familial relationship in our lives, every business relationship, commercial relationship that we have. The idea of customer service, the customer is always right. You know, we're a service company. Service is our number one priority. That notion is not motivated from caring about the individual who walks through the door. It's motivated in providing a service, meeting a need that will command a price in trade.
Making it easy for you to spend your money.
Right. And so the ironic observation here is that the left tells us we should all care about each other. Well, the mechanism by which we all care about each other is our own self-interest, our own profit motive. You take the profit motive away, and there is no reason to care about anybody else. And so nobody does. You know, I have firsthand experience of this. I've told this story before, where in one of the places that I've lived prior to where I fortunately happen to be now, I spent a year, me and my wife and our first kid, in a duplex where the folks on the other side of the wall were Russian immigrants. And they were obviously recent Russian immigrants. And you could tell because their attitude was horrific. They were extraordinarily self-centered, vindictive, vicious people. And I'll spare you the stories. Suffice it to say, they were products of the culture they came from. When you live under a system, when you live in a society that has no incentive for you to care about other people because there is no self-interest, there is no profit motive, everything is dispensed to you, and the only competition is butting the other runt out of line in the trough so that you can scoop up your slop. When that's the dynamic of your society, you're not going to be benevolent to your fellow man and woman, to your comrade. You're not going to care about whether or not they live or die. You're going to see them only as potential fuel, as an obstacle, as competition in the worst sense of the word, not in the market sense. This is what socialism does. There's one more factor aside from knowledge and care that Jonathan Newman points to as the reason why families are able to function, at least seemingly, as a commune, and the rest of the world, the outside world, the national level, cannot. We'll take your calls and share that third angle with you when we return. 651-989-5855. Closing argument, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So we've been going through this piece at Mises.org written by Jonathan Newman, where he asked the question, why do socialists hate families? And, you know, we've been analyzing why is it that the family structure, how a family functions and works as a unit, appears to be more or less communistic, right? I mean, it's basically a commune where people are serving each other's needs and there's a sort of common property and everything's run by consensus. You know, there's a hierarchy, obviously, but that hierarchy is less dictatorial in functional families. It's less dictatorial than it is a decision guided by the rational self-interest of each individual filtered through the expertise of the parent, the head of household, right? So how is it that that works within the context of a family, but it doesn't work on a national level or as a state or as a city? There are two factors we've gone over so far, two out of three. The first being knowledge and the other being care. Families have an intimate knowledge of each other, of each individual within the family, and therefore know what they need to do, can anticipate the needs of other family members without having that kind of market mechanism of price. In addition to that, families also, surprisingly, deeply care about one another. And that caring serves as an incentive and a motivation to provide the things that each of the family members need. Now, there is no such caring or knowledge outside of the family, which is why we need price, both as an incentive to get people to do the things that to serve our needs, the incentive of, hey, I'll pay you, and also for knowledge, because what that price says, the number, conveys to both producers and consumers what they ought to do next. Should they make more, make less, save, consume? The third factor here, detailed by Jonathan Newman at Mises.org, is outside information. He writes, families are little price-free islands in a sea of prices. We can easily refer to market prices to help us make decisions in the home as a family. While there are no prices within the household, there are prices outside the household that help us economize resources. This is how socialist countries can last as long as they do. They rely on the prices of various goods and services in other countries. Even firms need external markets for factors to be able to properly reckon profits and losses and make investment decisions. In this sense, Marxists are right to refer to families as units of consumption. My wife and daughter's happiness is my happiness. We have the same budget, so we know our individual spending choices impact each other. Large purchases are only made with consensus. Therefore, the unity of the family is a positive, not a negative, like the Marxists suggest. This cannot work at the national level, as we have seen. Or it does work, but only for a short while, and at a severe disadvantage to having market prices both outside and inside the country. Nations are not units of consumption like individuals or families with a single budget and closely aligned preferences over commonly owned set of resources. And so he concludes by writing, these ideas on how families survive the economic calculation problem imply that strong, thriving families are ones in which the members know a lot about each other, care a lot about each other, and are unified in their decision making. Knowledge about each other can only come by many shared experiences and honest communication. Care for each other can be rooted in shared religious beliefs and the duties and affections that come from the shared faith. Unity naturally flows once these are established. And so it's obvious, is it not, looking at this analysis, why a family might appear to be a commune in function, but only a family can for these reasons. The broader nation cannot do these things. And furthermore, I think it's worth noting that the commune nature of the family is ideal only up to a point. And we know this. Why? Because kids move out. If the ideal for human behavior was to function in the kind of codependent way that families do, when they're in the nuclear family. If that was the ideal, then why would kids ever move out of their house? Why wouldn't we just, why wouldn't we live in tribes and clans like they used to out in the wilderness, right? Why is it that people seek after their own place to live and their own careers and indeed starting their own new families? It's because the ideal is to function as your own unit with your own partner, not to continue under the care and instruction of your mom and dad until the day they die and you're left with no one to guide you any longer.
Oh, maybe that's why millennials like socialism.
Maybe it is. So, little food for thought for you. I thought this was a good piece at Mises, and we'll get it posted out on the social media channels, and I recommend you take a look at it. It's particularly interesting. We didn't go over it here tonight, but the actual text from Marx and Engels attacking the family and the reason why they're opposed to the family, which, you know, ironically, this piece doesn't really get into, but their excerpts do. They view the family as a perpetuator of capitalistic ideas, which they're correct about that. That's the great irony, is that the family serves as a model to future generations of how production and consumption work and how the morality of self-interest works. And the abolition of the family is a necessary point of conquering, a necessary waypoint on the journey towards turning society socialistic, because it removes the major primary institution through which young people learn what self-interest is and what it looks like and why it's valuable. This is why abortion is a thing. This is why sexual perversion has been elevated as a virtue. We'll get into it and take your calls when we return. 651-989-5855, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. It is Friday. That means Freestyle Friday. Lindsay, we give you a wide latitude in the topical direction of the program. 651-989-5855 is the number to join us. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing the show. Let's spin the wheel of fortune. Go with Ted in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Walter. Yeah, great to be on the program. Great talking. You're talking about the last segment. So that form of government would never work because Occupy Wall Street tried that, and that whole organization just completely fell apart based on their...
But yeah. Anyways,
I wanted to mention about last night. You said you were going to look into the Russian doomsday submarines and the torpedo that explodes a nuclear bomb under the ocean. You said that was... You're like, well, that sounds like Dr. Evil.
Right.
Well, Vladimir Putin is Dr. Evil.
Right.
And, you know, I wish this show would concentrate more on national defense is one of the, it's the very most important issue of all. And I wish that this show would concentrate more on that issue because it seems like you bring it up and I got mocked for that. And it's like,
I wasn't trying to mock you. I was just saying it does sound like at first glance, it sounds silly. Right. But then again,
they're good at psychological warfare, but Putin is Dr. Evil, and they are making this weapon that, I mean, they claim they are. I don't know. It might be psychological warfare, but I'm just saying.
Well, any newfangled weapon, you know, if you were in, I don't know the exact year that the nuclear bomb was created and made public, but prior to its development, if you would try to describe somebody, yeah, they have this bomb, and when it explodes, it creates this huge mushroom cloud, and the sky turns red, and you know that would have sounded crazy to people then, right? So there's kind of a similar thing going on with this. Now, because you brought it up, you called us in again, I must confess, I did not look into the nuclear tsunami torpedo last night.
Yeah, it's out there.
As I put nuclear torpedo in Google, one, like the third thing down in the auto feel is tsunami. So let's find out. Let's find out what's going on.
Hey, you know, they keep getting stronger every day, and it just seems like America, we're just kind of holding our own on this defense. But China's getting stronger. Russia's getting stronger. Iran, North Korea.
Well, in a nutshell, it's obviously a passionate topic for you. What do you think we should be doing differently than what we're doing now?
Well, we got to keep Republican in there, because if the Democrats get in there, they're going to negotiate away everything we have. So it's like the most important thing is we got to have Republican candidates in there that understand national defense. Then other than that, I mean, I don't know what you do.
All right. I appreciate the call, Ted. Thanks for sharing it with us. Popular Mechanics, of all places. Russia's nuclear tsunami apocalypse torpedo is named Poseidon. I guess it's a real thing. I guess it's the real deal.
I mean, to Ted's point, the generals, the chief of staff, are worried about Russia, are worried about China. The national defense budget is the biggest it has ever been. So to think that we're not worried about national defense is just his own fantasy, to talk about it more. But you read anything from a general today, and I'll say, near peer allies in Russia and China, near peer allies in Russia and China. I promise you we are worried about it. It's just that it's not the hot issue for the American public right now. So people, like, they're talking about the Green New Deal and Medicare for all, not veterans benefits, because people don't care about national defense anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those issues where, absent, first of all, there's very little we know about the dynamics that are taking place between nations at any given point. I mean, it's obscured, right? There's this kind of fog of war, so to speak, of what's taking place on the international stage. It's not particularly sexy. There's nothing really controversial until something actually happens, right? And also, I think for the most part, we're all pretty much on board with the status quo of where national defense is at. I mean, there's some people who would like it to like us to spend less and be in fewer places. There are other people who think we should spend more and be more aggressive. But on the whole, I don't see this massive national defense debate taking place that's worthy of our attention, which is why we haven't given it a whole lot. So there it is. Let's talk to Will in New Hope. Welcome to the program.
Hello?
Yep.
Hi. I'm a second-year history major at a state university. And you guys are kind of, you know, my political teachers in a way, opening my eyes to politics, especially current politics. I was just wondering if you think it's worth to get that degree to be a loyal conservative and a good American.
All right. Well, here's my question I'll ask you rather than giving you an answer, because, you know, I think the first thing to note is that there's no possible way that I could make that kind of a judgment about your life with the little bit of information I have at this point. So why did you go to college in the first place?
Well, I've always wanted to teach history. I've found it interesting from the time I was 6 years old all the way through high school. And I really wanted to teach that to people.
Well, it sounds like that end would be well served by continuing to secure your degree.
Is there a way I can be a good conservative and a good American while being in an academic system that says that you guys have seen as un-American?
Absolutely. I mean, you can be a good conservative, as you say, wherever you find yourself. And indeed, I would say that we need more folks with the proper philosophical mindset within these institutions than outside of them. So by all means, I would say move forward.
Thank you.
Hey, Will, have you looked in? Where do you go to school? Do you mind?
St. Cloud State University.
Okay. I guess that's a little more. You even get like harassed as a conservative in St. Cloud?
No. I started to see it creep in a little bit, but
yeah,
you know, I was just concerned that I wasn't a good American.
Are there any conservative groups or outreach organizations
there? I know there is.
Yeah, there are.
Can you get involved with them? That might give you a better sense of community, or even start your own. There are organizations like Students for Liberty where you can start your own.
Well, no, and you know, the Silver Shirts are there also.
What is that?
So. Oh, William Pelley Silver Shirts?
I don't know
what that is. But, I mean, I think if you want to major in history and be in the education system as a conservative, you are in a great position yourself, once you complete your degree, to influence young minds in the way that liberals are doing now. Like,
right.
You can be the other voice in that system, especially from a history standpoint. To actually teach the America's past, right?
From another perspective.
What's that?
Wouldn't that just be brainwashing from another perspective?
Not necessarily.
No, because it's so. Here's the thing. There's two. The approach to teaching, and I don't know how much latitude you have as a, and I don't know what level of teaching you're talking about doing, but there's two basic approaches, broadly speaking. One is to try to hammer into kids' heads what they should think, and that's the brainwashing of which you speak. The other is to train them up into how to think, and you get to choose your approach to how you're going to teach the material. And so, you know, you can teach it in such a way as to foster interest in the subject amongst your students and to get them to explore it so that it becomes less a you spoon feeding them historical dates and facts and personages and what have you, and more them learning about an aspect of history that interests them and that it tells them something that actually models a concept that they can apply to their real lives. You can get creative with it.
All right, thank you.
Yep, absolutely. Appreciate the call. Well, I hope for the best for Will.
Me too. I mean, if you're a conservative or libertarian student out there, like, don't drop out just because the ideology of the college campus doesn't agree with you.
Right.
I went through college as a libertarian. Yeah. I was involved in libertarian organizations in college, and I mean, I went to school in South Dakota, so it's probably more insulated than the coasts and a lot of the, even here at the U of M. But I was still a minority. There was, speaking out as a libertarian versus even as a conservative or as a Democrat was just unheard of. Mm-hmm. And in my academic discussions anyways, I double majored in political science and journalism. The fact that you had a different opinion other than the typical liberal or conservative talking point, the professors wanted to hear it. They might disagree with you,
right,
but they're like, hey, this kid's thinking.
Right.
And I think they at least respected that. And you have the power to influence the conversation. It just takes starting a group. When I started the College Libertarians at USD, I made the front page of the student newspaper simply because it was a new political organization on campus. So if you are savvy enough, you can have a bigger influence on the conversation than your current political clout might suggest. I mean, think of how many libertarians you know. Well, there's one here right on the radio influencing the articles we talk about on the radio show to a bunch of conservatives. So in that regard, I have positioned myself to have more influence on the conversation than I might in the voting booth.
There are Turning Point USA is the organization that Candace Owens is affiliated with. It's a Trump-friendly conservative organization. They have 7 different chapters here in Minnesota. One of them is at St. Cloud State University. That's just one organization. I know the College Republicans are active up there. I have no doubt that there's probably Students for Liberty up there as well. If not, it's certainly achievable to form a chapter. So, you know, look, people on the right are certainly marginalized and at a disadvantage in many ways within higher education, but that's not a reason to bail out. When I first saw on the caller screen board that Will was calling to ask about whether or not he should stay in a college, I didn't think he was going to come at it from that direction of it's ideologically poisonous, why do I want to be here? I thought he was going to come at it from an occupational direction of, does it make sense for me? Because to me, that's the question to ask. It's an economic calculation. What do I want to do occupationally, and is a college degree going to be both necessary and or advantageous towards succeeding in that occupation? If the answer is yes, and if the economic value of working in that occupation is greater than the cost of going to school over however many years, then by all means, you should move forward. If he called me up and said, hey, I'm a major in women's studies, or, you know, competitive dance or something along those lines, then I might have advised them differently. So we're not anti-college. We're anti-stupid college.
Well, and if you listen to Dave Ramsey, he talks about this a lot, and it's, I kind of disagree with him somewhat on it, because he says, like, don't take out student loans, don't go to college unless you know how you're going to pay for it out of pocket. But if you do it correctly and you go in a major that is going to have an economic value to you, then I think it might be worth it. But you should at least be thoughtful about the economics of college.
Yeah, Ramsey's aversion to taking on debt of any kind, I think, is pretty extreme. I mean, you even look at somebody like a, I can't think of the guy's last name, but it's the rich dad, poor dad guy, Robert K. something. He's all about the debt. He's like, look, there's a difference between good debt and bad debt. And a going into debt for an asset that's going to pay you down the road is not something you should be have an aversion towards. And certain college education qualifies by that standard, but it depends on what it is. And you better have a good sense of your ability to translate that education into an economic value, or you're just going into debt for no reason. Unless you just really, really love to know whatever the subject matter is, in which case...
Read a book?
There are other ways you can get that knowledge. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name's Walter Atson, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. So this analysis that we went through last hour from Mises.org, written by Jonathan Newman, of why socialists hate the family, the nuclear family, it really kind of brings to light, it lets the gears, the teeth of the gears kind of mesh together. Everything falls into place as to why it is that the left takes the positions that they do on these so-called social issues. Why they're so on fire for abortion. Why they're so on fire for changing our perception of gender and turning into a spectrum and redefining gender roles and redefining masculinity and femininity. Why they're interested in promoting, you know, various sexual perversions as normal and acceptable. Because they're trying to cut the legs out from underneath capitalism. And those legs are the family. The family is the institution. It's the base mechanism through which the next generation, future generations, are taught things like self-interest, production, responsibility, accountability, and primarily, perhaps above all, caring, how to actually care about other human beings, and what that looks like, what it feels like, and what it makes possible. Actual intentional cooperation around common shared values, which ironically can only take place in a condition of individual liberty. It's only when you're free to act as an individual and choose your relationship and choose the terms upon which that relationship moves forward, it's only in that context that actual meaningful cooperation can take place. And all of these notions are things that are taught implicitly in the context of family. And so that's why it must end. From Reason. A rule change on abortion referrals creates unreasonable barriers, according to a United States judge. A rule banning health clinics from referring patients for abortions if they receive federal family planning funds has been blocked nationwide per a new U.S. District Court ruling. The Thursday order from Judge Stanley Bastian puts a temporary injunction on a rule change issued by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in March. HHS has barred any group that gets certain federal funds from promoting, encouraging, or advancing abortion in any way, or from providing patients with specific information about where they can obtain one. In addition, such entities would have to maintain a clear physical and financial separation from any related entities that perform abortions, a movement to strike a blow at Planned Parenthood. Under the longstanding rules of Title X funding, which theoretically supports reproductive health and family planning services for low-income Americans, using this money to perform or support abortion services was already off-limits. But with the March HHS policy, doctors and other staff at places that received Title X funds would also be prohibited from referring patients to abortion providers or offering information about the procedure in a way that seemed to condone it. The department believes that in most cases, when a referral is provided for abortion, that referral necessarily treats abortion as a method of family planning, the HHS guidance states. Thus, such a referral makes the Title X project or clinic a program, one where abortion is a method of family planning, contrary to the prohibition against the use of Title X funds for such programs. We're getting in the weeds here with why this policy was formulated in the first place. In his decision, Judge Bastian says the rule change reverses longstanding positions of the department without proper consideration of, get this, sound medical opinions and the economic and non-economic consequences. Wow, you'd almost think we weren't talking about the intentional termination of human life. He found it likely that the change runs afoul of the Affordable Care Act and likely violates the central purpose of Title X, which is to equalize access to comprehensive, evidence-based, and voluntarily family planning. So, you know, mangled in all of this legalese of this federal court ruling is an obfuscation of the fact that we're talking about murdering children. And it's being discussed in sanitary legalese fashion as if, you know, what's at stake is just whether or not the letter of a particular statute is upheld through administrative bureaucratic juggling. There's a little bit more at stake than that. And, you know, there's two reflections upon this decision that I'd like to make. The first, tying in with what we talked about last hour, with the family being an underpinning of capitalism and a mechanism through which the morality of self-interest is taught through experience. You know, you learn how to be a productive, self-interested, caring individual within the context of a family. And that presents an inherent threat to the socialists. It presents an inherent threat to the altruists who say that your values, your self-interest should not be part of the equation. Everything should be bureaucratic. Everything should be hidden behind a screen and decided by some far-off oligarchy in a dispassionate, inhuman way. Abortion makes sense because you want to, first of all, minimize the number of family connections that exist in the world, because family connection unto itself presents a threat to your worldview, but also because their philosophy is inherently and literally anti-life. I mean, it makes sense that the same people who think that it's wrong for human beings to seek after their own self-interest would be against the ultimate manifestation of that interest, which is life itself. And of course, the other aspect of this that I think is worth noting is that these types of clashes of value always take place wherever you see government controlling an economic interest. So, you know, it's interesting how the government decides when and where your values get to be applied to the dispensation of your own money. The purpose of the Trump administration's rule in this case is an attempt to bring the conduct of these healthcare providers who receive Title X funding into alignment with the intent of the law. And you get this judge who comes along with his legal interpretation that says, no, you know, we need to adjust things in order to bring into a greater compliance with this other law over here. And in both cases, the problem is you have government intervening in the transmission of value that takes place in a free market. The solution to this, aside from banning the murder of unborn children, which absolutely ought to happen, the economic solution to this is getting government out of people's economic decisions so that they can make decisions with their own money. And therefore, it doesn't become a matter of a federal case, literally, in this case. 651-989-5855, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
Well, I came upon the child of God. He was walking along the road, and I asked him, tell me, where are you going?
Another attack on the family that is utilized to tear individual families apart I believe, as part of the overall antagonism that the left has towards the concept of the family, is the abuse of child protective services. Now, of course, there are real abusers of children out there in the world, and they ought to be rooted out, and they ought to be prosecuted, and they ought to be punished to the fullest extent of the law. But these child protective services organizations throughout the nation often go much further than that moral mandate would require. And they destroy the lives of innocents in the process. And there's one such example here that we're going to bring to your attention from the Daily Wire. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We're here 8 to 10 weeknights. Freestyle Friday. We'll take your calls and go in whatever direction you want to drag us. 651-989-5855. Brad Omland taking those calls and producing this show. The Lothar family of New Mexico found themselves in the crosshairs after a teacher at the four-year-old daughter's school claimed that the girl reported that she'd been sexually abused by her father and her seven-year-old brother. The district attorney would eventually decline to move forward with the case because there was no evidence whatsoever. The child's story changed wildly in the telling and included a number of obviously fantastical details. The father passed multiple polygraph tests, and it's likely that the girl was really just describing her father helping her wipe after using the toilet, something all parents have done for their children many times. But in between the initial report from the girl and the DA's decision to drop the whole matter, the Lothar family was ripped apart. The children were placed in foster care. The father was fired from his job and labeled a child rapist by the media. The young girl was subjected to lengthy interrogations and extraordinarily invasive physical exams. The family was forced to shell out $300,000 in legal expenses. And the accused father and his wife were both summarily stripped of all parental rights, not to mention their Fourth, Sixth, and Eighth Amendment rights as well. The most frightening aspect of the story is the malicious and underhanded manner with which the New Mexico Children, Youth, and Families Department and local police operated throughout the proceedings. They decided from the outset that Adam Lothar must be guilty, because who has ever heard of a four-year-old kid telling a fantastical story, and treated him like a child-raping felon accordingly. These agencies were interested in establishing guilt by whatever means necessary, not ascertaining the objective truth. They also had the advantage of a system that automatically turns entire families into wards of the state as soon as someone in government decides that someone in that family may have done something wrong. After being contacted by the school, the police forced their way into the family's home without a warrant and forbade the mother, Jessica, from speaking to her children. Can you imagine this? Can you imagine this happening in your own home, your own family? No warrant. They just come into your house, take your children, and forbid you from speaking to them. This is real. This is the United States of America. This happened. Eventually, the children would end up in foster care. They were briefly returned to Jessica's custody, the mother. Adam, the father, was not allowed to see his kids for several months after the initial arrest. But she had to have her parents move in and act as safety monitors. That was a requirement. Her parents had to move in to watch her kids. I'm surprised they even allowed relatives to serve that role. I'm surprised they didn't just have, like, stormtroopers camped out in this house. The children were removed from their mother's custody once again when the Child Protective Services Department got word that the safety monitors didn't believe in Adam's guilt. So there you go. I spoke too soon. Oh, so a requirement of being a safety monitor is believing presumptively in the guilt of the accused. Astounding. Now, this is written by Matt Walsh over at the Daily Wire, and he continues writing. He says, I recently finished the second volume of The Gulag Archipelago, a magnum opus about the Soviet labor camp system. And the Lothar family's experiences seem to bear certain uncomfortable resemblances, and their story is not unique. Many innocent mothers and fathers have similarly discovered that they have no rights and no presumption of innocence once the despots at child services come knocking. It is a nightmare scenario that every parent dreads. What if your child goes to school with a story he made up in his head? Or repeats something he heard from a friend, or for whatever reason, says something that accidentally implicates you as an abuser or worse. My 5-year-old daughter likes to erroneously claim that her twin brother punched her in the head. I've seen both of them smack each other on various occasions, but I've never seen my son punch anyone. Kids make up stories. If they're young enough, they don't even know that they're making it up. Children before the age of reason cannot fully distinguish between a lie and the truth. So what if my daughter went out in public one day and told a slightly different version of her familiar yarn? Daddy punched me in the head. That would be enough, it seems, to land my kids in foster care and me behind bars. Every parent is in this boat. The only thing keeping our parental rights intact is that our kids haven't made up the wrong kind of story and told it to the wrong person, which is another way of saying that we don't really have parental rights. If child services can revoke those rights at any time without evidence, without investigation, without reasonable cause, without even a consistent or credible accusation, then what does it mean to say that we have the rights in the first place? Matt Walsh concludes saying, I believe, of course, that actual allegations of abuse must be investigated. Certainly, we can't ignore a child who claims that their parents are abusing them. Some parents really are guilty of these horrible crimes, but due process cannot go out the window. Unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats from social services cannot be empowered to act as prosecutor, judge, and jury. The rights of the parents and the best interest of the children must be absolutely preserved and respected at all times, but that is simply not how these cases often play out. It's stunning to me that this has not resulted in a lawsuit making its way up to the Supreme Court, this type of, because this is not, as Matt Walsh points out, this is not unique. This is not novel. It's not the first time a case like this has occurred. And, you know, perhaps it's because by time all said and done, I bet you two factors play into why we haven't seen a Supreme Court case regarding child protective services. Number one, the legal cost of just protecting yourself. This family, and I don't know how rich they were before or if they were rich at all, but they racked up $300,000 worth of legal fees to protect themselves against a false accusation. All the meanwhile having their family literally pulled apart, torn apart. And so by the time you get done with all of that, do you really have the financial and or energetic capital with which to push forward and try to seek justice from those who've harmed you? Probably not. But this is extraordinarily problematic. This is a gross violation of people's rights and incredibly traumatic. I mean, the whole purported purpose of child protective services is to, you know, protect the child. How is a child protected in a case like this? What's more traumatic? The possibility that the father did what the kid is accusing him of, or the reality of what the kid had to go through during this quote-unquote investigation. And it's not as though it's something, it's an episode in their lives, like it happened and now they can just move on as if everything's cool now. This has fundamentally transformed their entire familial experience. This is a defining episode that's going to have repercussion for the rest of each of their lives. People should have to pay for that. The agencies involved and the specific people involved in making the decisions that led to the ruination of this family should be made to pay, both civilly and criminally, and they would in a just society. 651-989-5855. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Mere moments away from starting your weekend closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Freelance Friday, 651-989-5855. Guess we'll take a couple of those calls. Let's go with Mike in Farmington. Nice to hear from you.
Hey, good evening, Walter. Thank you for taking my call.
Yep.
I'll try to, from somebody who's been there, I'm actually going to go at Ronald Reagan, and that may surprise you, but here's where I'm going with this. I think it was back in 69 when Reagan signed a family bill that allowed no-fault divorce. So all of a sudden now you have this whole industry with divorce lawyers and the whole court system and the family court system. And I've been there, and I'm not going to insult your choice of marriage, but you get in a court system where they can make any claim they want. They can toss the husband right out of the house, and you're out. And now you're back on your heels. You're trying to fight this. And the whole system, at least I'm pretty bitter how it's been set up
against men. I understand.
And it's attacked the institution of marriage. And now you look at Western civilization. You have movements like MGTOW where men are just saying, it's too much of a risk. I have too much to lose. Guys that own their businesses, they can be divorced, raped. I think it would be nice if you could spend more on this topic, because there's a whole culture now where guys are just saying, it's too big of a risk. Yeah. I don't want to engage with women. I have too much to lose. Right. I'm just out. So there's a big problem in this legal system. The Child Protective Service is just a little part of it, but there is a big problem there.
I appreciate the call, Mike. Yeah, I'm very sorry to hear you've had that experience, and it's thankfully not aligned with my own. I will say, and this is true of any marriage, this is true of any relationship of any kind, actually, it very much depends upon the integrity of the people involved. I mean, that's what makes it work. And, you know, that's not to say that a marriage that lasts is one where no wrongs are ever committed. Quite the contrary. It simply means that there's a commitment to grace, a commitment to one another, and a assumption of self-interest between both parties. In other words, her interest is my interest, and my interest is hers. And that's what makes it work. And when that breaks down, that's where you get into these scenarios with the aid, the intentional constructed aid of the legal status quo. You get into these scenarios where people's lives are just utterly ruined and destroyed in the courts and through the legal system. And it is wrong, and it does need to stop. Let's talk with Sue in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Walter. Hi. I agree with all the things you said about, but there's also another side. This was a couple years ago. I'll never forget this picture because I can still see the picture of this little child who was murdered by his mother in the paper.
Right.
He was about 3 or 4 years old, beautiful child.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason what happened in this case was the government. They decided that there were too many children. I think he was white. So that wasn't his particular problem, but it affects everybody when you make these laws. They decided that too many people of color were getting multiple complaints about child abuse. And so they thought that was too much. So they treated every
complaint
as a first complaint.
Right.
You're familiar with that?
No, I'm not. I mean, I'm familiar with that type of thinking because we've seen that.
Lindsay County, I forget which county. It wasn't in St. Paul.
Yeah.
But so they decided that every complaint should be treated as a first complaint.
Right.
And there were multiple complaints. And this picture of this beautiful child with his two little black eyes and that sweet smile on his face is picked. He was a child, and when your child and your picture is being taken, you smile, even though you have two black eyes.
Right.
And that child ended up dead because you could only count every complaint about him as a first complaint.
Well, I mean, look, the what you bring to bear in these cases, which you ought to bring to bear, and I appreciate the call, Sue, is rational due process, right? I mean, it's not as though we have a choice between a legal system that ignores objective evidence of wrongdoing and a legal system that presumes the guilt of anybody whose kid says something about them, right? Like there is a choice between those two extremes, and it's called due process. You know, the disparate impact rationale that Sue cites there for, oh, you know, we got to treat every case as every report as a first report because there's been too many accusations coming from the black community or whatever community it is that, you know, you're particularly interested in. And, you know, that's inherently racist. And so we need to change how we approach the handling of these cases in order to equalize the treatment of the races. Well, that's an irrational premise. It's an evil premise. It's a racist premise. And that's why that kid is dead. Once again, I'd just like to highlight the point that socialism kills. The left kills. The left is anti-life. And it's not hyperbole. It's not rhetoric. It's not an exaggeration. There is objective, documented evidence, 100 million people dead in the USSR. And that's the broad statistical example. And then you get this personal example of the one child whose life could have been saved if due process had not been interfered with by irrational, silly, childish concerns over disparate impact. Let's talk with Michael in St. Louis Park. Welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening, Walter. How are you?
Good.
Excellent. Say, I was just wondering, I wanted to shift lanes over to Monday when you spoke with Kip.
Yeah.
And Kip was definitely speaking your language, and you were speaking his. It seems that everything that he was talking about, a program that he wants to implement, you've been pushing for and pounding on the table for the last couple of years. I'm wondering what could hold Kip's vision from not going forward. Is that a proposal that he's making that could possibly get shot down, or where does the proposal that he's talking about, where does that stand, and how can it be implemented? Or how will it be implemented?
Well, I'm not sure which specific proposal you're referencing. I mean, what he proposed was basically an approach to professionalizing the Republican Party.
Right.
So,
how will that be pushed forward, so to speak? Or how do you envision that being pushed forward? And what's the potential of it getting knocked down or pushed back, so to speak? Because it was right on target with what you have been talking about for years now.
Yeah, we're right up against the end of the show, but unfortunately it's not going to take a whole long time for me to answer this question. I appreciate the call, Michael. What's going to happen if Kip gets elected tomorrow, and this meeting is taking place tomorrow where they're going to determine the leadership of the Republican Party in Minnesota henceforth, the first step is having somebody in leadership with this vision. And that is going to hopefully bring people to the table with the commitment of funding that'll make that vision possible. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.